Call to order the White Salmon City Council meeting for May 6th. Jan, would you like to do roll call?
Yes. Jason Hartman?
Here.
David Lindley?
Here.
Amy Martin?
Here.
Ashley Post?
Here.
Joe Turkowitz?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, we are allowing public comment. This is our first meeting where we are having public comments since we started virtual. Just so everyone knows going forward, any emails that are received by Jan Brending by 5 o'clock of the day of our meeting will be entered into the record. She will read through all the comments that have been received and who was the sender. And then Jan, will we be sending a digital copy of those to all the counselors afterwards or?
Yeah, what I'll do is print them and just scan them into one file so you don't have like multiple emails and you'll just get a single email with them all in one scanned document.
Okay, so we will go through public comment that's been received as of 5 p.m. today.
Okay, this email is from Janet Warren and Mark Schmidt. I believe they are actually attending and listening in via telephone. Dear Governor Inslee, Attorney General Ferguson, and White Salmon Mayor Marla Keithler, we are abiding by all of the state and local guidance relating to addressing the serious issue of COVID-19 and appreciate your leadership now as well as in the past. Our Sheriff, Sheriff Songer, today, May 5th, indicated that he will not enforce the governor's COVID-19 rules in Klickitat County. And then I'll read the post. We've already placed phone calls as well as sent this letter. My husband and I are 71 and 65 respectively. We live in Klickitat County as well as the city of White Salmon. Our sheriff has just announced that he does not intend to enforce Washington state guidelines related to COVID-19. He is literally putting our lives in danger. Please help us. Thank you. What should we do? What are our legal rights regarding the protection of our health? We are also sending this note to our local Klickitat Health Department, our area hospitals, as well to our senators, Senator Murray and Senator Cantwell. And they're referring to Sheriff Songer's post on GorgeNewsCenter.com. And that post says, Governor Inslee's orders pertaining to public gatherings or businesses operating in violation of his orders, in my opinion, is a violation of our citizens' constitutional rights under the First Amendment, Second Amendment, and other amendments of the U.S. Constitution and Washington State Constitution. Not allowing citizens to attend church or firearm dealers to conduct business is a violation of the First Amendment and the Second Amendment, but the governor has no problem allowing marijuana shops to stay open for business. As sheriff, I will uphold our citizens' constitutional rights and liberties and will not enforce Governor Inslee's COVID-19 proclamation orders on public gatherings and non-essential businesses. No crisis should ever violate a citizen's liberty or God-given rights under our Constitution or U.S. Constitution or Washington State Constitution. Bob Songer, Sheriff Klickitat County. And then they added, please let us know what we should do and what we can do legally. Thank you for your work. It followed up today with a second email, and they included an attachment from the Attorney General that was written in February of 2019 related to enforcement of I-1639. And their comments here, I've attached the PDF document of Attorney General Ferguson's first February 2019 response to Songer about his refusal to abide by I-1639 and therefore the rule of law in general. The content is also provided below. Perhaps some of the reasoning is applicable within this situation related to Governor Inslee's COVID orders. And then they highlighted, I'm not going to read the whole Attorney General Ferguson's response, but they highlighted a paragraph which says, under Article 1, Section 1 of Washington State Constitution, all political power is inherent in the people, and the governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed and are established to protect and maintain individual rights. As public officers, our duty is to abide by the will of the people we serve and implement and enforce the laws they adopt. I encourage you to do so. Attorney General Ferguson, February 2019, to Sheriff Songer. And then they write, my husband and I are on Facebook on many local government gorge sites, including Goldendale and the Dalles. Normally, the demographics of these groups are very supportive of anything that might be considered the conservative response or position. Other people posted his recent May 5th announcement to those sites. Those folks have posted Songer's notes and have been angry, horrified, and surprised. We are in a pandemic. He's making this political now. It is not. And these comments are coming from his usual supporters. Last month on March 30th, Songer posted on the official Klickitat County Sheriff site a lengthy supportive video about social distancing and how he was supporting it in his role of sheriff. Sitting in his kitchen at home, he read an official statement to Klickitat County, and they provided a link to that. Janet Warren and Mark Smith. So we got a letter from Jennifer Salapi and Chris Austinus. Dear White Salmon Council members and commissioners, we are concerned with Sheriff Songer's declaration that he will not enforce any of the temporary laws to ensure public safety during COVID-19. Sheriff Songer is an elected official for a nonpartisan position to uphold the laws and safety of our county citizens. He was not elected to create or interpret those laws. There are other elected offices that do just those things. If he believes those laws are unconstitutional, then he needs to pursue that through the courts. He was not elected to pick and choose which laws fit his political views, opinions, or leanings, and enforce or not enforce as he sees fit. He was elected to enforce the law to ensure the safety of our community. By defying these temporary rules, he is putting people's lives in harm's way. All of our efforts thus far will come undone, and the impact it has had on our livelihoods and personal freedoms will all be for naught. His actions are short-sighted and, in our opinion, self-serving and dangerous. If Mr. Songer doesn't want to enforce laws that are put in place to maintain public safety during this unprecedented time, does that mean doctors, hospitals, and medical clinics have the right to refuse testing or refuse care to people who aren't willing to take measures to protect themselves? His inaction will result in an inappropriate burden put on our local healthcare system and will gravely impact our public health and confidence. We need more cohesion and less confusion. We ask you to do whatever is in your power to correct the situation. They are business owners and residents of White Salmon. An email from Gigi Pomerantz, who lives at 954 Main Avenue here in White Salmon. Dear Mayor, I just read of Sheriff Songer's refusal to enforce the governor's stay-at-home ruling and allow, in parens, encourage, people to gather at churches and gun shops, an essential service. I am appalled. I thought it was bad enough that he wouldn't enforce the law regarding purchasing firearms, but this takes the cake. Sheriff Songer should be sanctioned and, if possible, removed from office. How can we have an officer of the law who refuses to obey the law? How can I feel safe in White Salmon knowing people are gathering without observing social physical distancing? How can I feel safe when I know people are buying guns without background checks or possibly underage? How can I feel safe with Sheriff Songer? Here's an email from Karen Skiles, Wanna Street, White Salmon. I'm writing to express my outrage that Sheriff Songer can be allowed to select which laws he enforces and to choose not to enforce the governor's COVID response measures. He holds that office to protect all of the citizens of Klickitat County, not just his radical right-wing cronies. As a resident of White Salmon, I ask that the City of White Salmon exert pressure on Governor Inslee and the Klickitat County Commissioners to protect our health and well-being by bringing Songer into compliance with the laws that he is in office to uphold. This is an email from April George, who lives in White Salmon. I hope this letter finds you, this is addressed to the mayor, finds you, your family, and your friends well during these difficult times. I'm a member of the community of White Salmon and I work in the schools. Since the shutdown, I and many others are trying hard to follow the advice and guidelines of public health officials, despite some of it not being comfortable or convenient. One of those guidelines is the wearing of face mask in public. I and others have noticed that not everyone is heeding the advice. I'm wondering if you might consider the following suggestion. Confer with local businesses in our community regarding mask wearing. Perhaps a coalition of business owners concerned about the safety of their frontline workers could agree to announcing that they want people to don masks before entering their places of business and share through media, posters, and word of mouth why. Knowing that this is difficult to enforce, the push could be civic and community responsibility towards one another. If feasible, perhaps masks could be made available at entry. We are rarely going out to public places, but when we do, it is encouraging to see folks showing respect and care for one another, but very worrisome to go out grocery shopping, for example, and see that our workers are taking precautions, but the customers are not. I hope that you'll at least consider trying to help our public be aware of safe practices. Thank you for your time and consideration. And the last one is just a general comment. I'll be referring this comment to our consultant that's working on this study. It's related to the watershed, the White Salmon River Source Reliability Study. Jan, thank you so much for talking to me about the upcoming study. My specific interest relates to the ways in which the existing watershed protection plan will change, and I would guess be strengthened. I would really appreciate any information you might have on this component of the study and its follow-on actions. I feel strongly that we must protect the health and viability of our watersheds. I commend the city for its high-level attention to this issue, Jacqueline Watt. And that's all we have.
Okay. This isn't a change to the agenda note, but since there were so many, or the majority of those letters were specific to the issue around Sheriff Songer's recent statement or COVID-19 related, just so the counselors know and anyone that's on the phone, we will discuss that more in depth on our business item number 8, the COVID-19 planning. We will have a discussion regarding legal authority, not only at the governor level, but also city and what this specific scenario with the county sheriff department and how that does or does not impact any city operations in our own police department. Otherwise, I will ask if there's any changes to the agenda, any other critical or essential items that counselors want to add to this meeting. Okay, seeing or hearing no additions, we will move into the items on the agenda. Just a reminder, when we get into business items, the votes will be taken by roll call. Jim will call everyone's name and you will verbally, audibly, register your vote so that everyone on the phone can hear. We're actually starting the meeting with a couple presentations. We will begin with Jeff King, and David Cavanaugh hopefully will be joining us as well. But these updates from the Emergency Operations Marla? Center, Jeff, who is the director.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Jeff, can you hear me? That's okay.
David's texting me saying he's in the waiting room.
No, he's on now.
Oh,
he's okay, in.
Great.
Okay.
I just got let in.
Perfect. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. No, thanks, Jeff. So I wanted to have Jeff and David join just to give the counselors some overview updates on where we are with the Emergency Operations Center and our local support and preparation for the COVID-19 dynamic that we find ourselves in for, I think, a longer period. Jeff will begin, and I think his update will be more general about our plans at the EOC for ongoing support during this crisis and a few other updates that he wanted to share.
Yes, hello. I'm going to keep my video off because it affects my bandwidth. Don't have the best out here. That will keep my audio stable. So first, thank you for having me. I am Jeff King, Director of Emergency Management for Clickat County, representing the county and all three cities. I'm also the Emergency Operations Center Incident Commander. I don't know if our EOC documents are being passed on to you. I know that Marla gets our situation reports and our incident action plans. on a regular basis, but there's good information in those documents for you. If you would like them, we can have them sent directly to you as city council persons. The Clickat County Emergency Operations Center is working and been activated to support the activities of the Public Health Department. We're in unified command with the Public Health Department, and David Cavanaugh is my partner incident commander. The EOC's primary purpose is to support the Public Health Department in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic in our county. We also have, based on the fact that this is a public health incident, we have few other roles, but to support the health department. One of those roles we have identified early on was the establishment of an essential supplies delivery service, specifically targeting individuals that are in the high-risk categories or in vulnerable populations, or people that are already in quarantine or isolated and either should be or are doing the right thing by staying home, in which they can call our call center, which is in conjunction with WAGAP, a Washington Gorge Action Program. And through a process, they can order supplies at grocery stores or pharmacies, and they pay for them and tell us when they're ready, we'll go pick them up and deliver them to their houses safely, using volunteers from fire departments, the sheriff's posse, and the search and rescue volunteer organization. Everything else that we do, for the most part, is supporting public health. I am happy to say that we're making progress in collaborating with other stakeholders in the Gorge. We've been, from the very beginning, involved with public health from March 3rd, I believe, when we officially stood up the EOC in unified command. And then secondarily with the healthcare providers at the hospitals, North Shore Clinic, and other clinics across the county. And most recently, with Gorge area landowners. We had a meeting last Friday. I don't know, Marla, if anybody's been shared any of that information. I don't want to repeat what you've already heard, but that generally speaking, that meeting was very good in my opinion. It included U.S. Forest Service, state parks, and other major public and private landowners discussing Gorge-wide and all seven counties represented how we are going to manage the opening of the Gorge for recreational activities and try to coordinate those efforts so that none of the smaller rural towns and cities are overwhelmed by visitors when it's still not appropriate. So I'm glad to see that's happening at this juncture, where in the beginning when we went into the restrictions, everybody was doing their own thing on their own timeline, mostly. We've also recently had a meeting with the fruit growers and processors in the county, specifically related to their migrant workers coming into the county, their need for proper H-2A housing for those, and the requirements from LNI to follow rules that cuts their normal level of housing by 50%. So they're looking for 50% more housing capacity to house their workers and get their crops picked and processed according to the new rules. So we worked to get feedback from them on challenges they were facing and ways that the county could support them in that process, and then also how we're going to respond to any outbreaks in their worker populations and the need for proper quarantine and isolation facilities. And I'll let David talk more about some of those things because they're more directly related to public health. The one challenge that we've had from the very beginning is staffing the EOC with appropriate personnel to respond to this event. Used a combination of county and city and local fire district employees throughout, as well as many volunteers, which I appreciate all of those folks that have been working for me for over 2 months now, most of them. And continuing that, we have a good plan in place right now for continued operations that will flux. People's availability always does. But we're also looking at, you know, what we're doing, why we're doing it, what we should be doing, and how, as conditions change, our the need for the EOC staffing will also change. And so that is in our planning wheel right now, to make sure that we have proper demobilization strategies in place. And also, Marla had identified there might be some questions about how we identify cases by zone. So we've set up a zone process very early on that identifies where patients are, and we chose the county outdoor burn ban zones because they're published across the county and known to most citizens, so something they would already recognize, hopefully, as the best way, because we cannot and even did not want to give out any more localized or specific location identifiers, because we live in such small communities that people would figure out who these confirmed patients are, and concerned about their privacy and even some cases of retaliation. So we've used that zone system, Zone 1, East County, Zone 2, Central County, and Zone 3, West County. And the bullet point I have also suggested was an overview of what happens when a positive case is identified. Public health can speak to that from their perspective. They notify me, as I also have responsibility over 911 dispatch. We flag that address in our dispatch computer system, so that whenever any responders go to that address or dispatch to that address, that they will know by what the dispatcher tells them. First of all, when the dispatcher pulls it up, there's a flag there that tells that dispatcher there is a person with a confirmed case of COVID-19 there, and that all responders, fire, law enforcement, and emergency medical services need to take proper precautions. See, and then another point was the PIO, so our public information. We are very strongly trying to work on positive messages to our citizens related to what they can do to best help themselves and others. And the last one that was put out just today, actually, earlier today, was titled Protecting Yourself and Others. We found that you know, repeating any of the governor's proclamations or orders just caused too much contention, especially on social media. So we've tried to get back to a local messaging directed at our local residents, and as personal as we can make it, letting them know that you know, we are their fellow neighbors, friends, sometimes relatives, that are trying to help them do what's best for them and their families and the whole community to keep us all healthy. So that's been a concerted effort in all of our public messaging for a couple of weeks now, at least, to try and turn the tide of all the negativity that was out there, especially on social media. And that has been successful so far. Generally speaking, though, we have seen an increase of resistance against that, but it is still the minority in our estimation. I think everything else I'll let David speak to. Are there any questions for emergency management or EOC operations specifically?
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you very much. I'm not seeing any hands or hearing.
I want to say one last thing.
I
appreciate all of your support through Marla. She has voiced that support for the EOC, and all of the city mayors are supporting our efforts. So I thank you for that.
Thank you. Appreciate you joining us this evening. And Dave Cavanaugh is also on the phone. As Jeff mentioned, he is the other incident commander and can speak on the health side of this current situation, give you guys some more details.
Yeah, so I'll jump right into the major four things, which are, contact tracing, quarantine and isolation, testing. And fourth one is that we're concentrating on is exposure to, high risk populations. But the first piece, update on testing capacity. KVH did get quite a few, when I say quite a few, thousands of test kits. So KVH is also now sharing or working out an agreement with Skyline, since Skyline has recently switched labs. So there was some trouble in the very beginning regarding, the testing media, but now that both are using saline, both will be using LabCorp, which seems to be a quicker turnaround also for some of these providers. And we are sitting on quite a lot of testing capacity moving into the next few months. The testing criteria has also expanded with the CDC guidance that recently came out that allows a little bit more, I would say, wiggle room for providers to order those tests. Before, it was a series or certain symptoms that would prompt people to get testing. So right now, I think our testing capacity is pretty good. We're working with some of our migrant housing facilities and some of those growers to figure out the logistical side of getting testing for symptomatic workers that are presented too. So that's another piece we're working on. Contact tracing has been, I would, in my opinion, be exceptional from the beginning of number one. We've been able to do the case investigation, notify the close contacts, establish the quarantine procedures, all within 24 hours of getting a confirmed report, which is pretty awesome. I think we're able to do that because we have some dedicated staff, and we're a bit smaller, and we haven't had the large daily caseload. We do have contingency plans for that in case we do see a cluster or a spike. We do have a few volunteers that have medical experience that we've begun with a little bit of training on them to get, as soon as they get their first contact tracing, they can start working on that. That is all, contingent on the amount of cases we get in a day. But we are able to do the contact tracing case investigation within 24-hour period right now, which is great. The quarantine and isolation has been a bit difficult. Most of our cases, actually all of our cases right now, have opted to quarantine and isolate at home, which is great. We still have to find a way to quarantine and isolate people that would not, that are either homeless or not wanting to quarantine at home. So we are trying to locate a few facilities that would be willing to do that. We only have a limited amount of grant money to cover some of those. Some of them are not sustainable from a monetary perspective. It won't only last a month or two. So we are looking into other options in that perspective. For the the high-risk populations, we're really focusing on our adult care centers and the migrant workers that are, you know, moving across county and state lines. We have daily calls out to those adult care facilities, making sure they have proper PPE moving forward, and that they don't, you know, that they're doing the screening for employees or, you know, the daily checks on some of their existing clients. You know, a lot of the questions that we're getting right now are variances. I know that's on a lot of people's mind moving forward, and I just wanted to give a little bit of feedback on that. Some of the criteria to even apply for a variance for these phases includes no new cases in a 3-week period and a 2% or lower positivity rate for testing. So right now we don't meet those two criteria. The second criteria about positivity rate is a table discussion. So even if you don't have the cases within 3 weeks, we could still technically apply with an approved plan by Secretary of Health, Dr. Wiesman, and the governor's office. So I know that's just been a hot topic. We've got a lot of emails this week regarding it. So is there any other piece or bullet point that you would like me to specifically address, Marla?
I don't think so. I definitely want to open it up and see if any counselors have questions. I guess I just have one question to clarify your last comment regarding that criteria. Is that for opening up variances in addition to the 10 counties that Governor Inslee called out, of which Klickitat County is not included?
Yeah, so he initially called out the 10, and then there was a follow-up email to public health staff after that that said, you know, these counties are in line if, you know, X and Y are met. And X and Y are no new cases in 3 weeks and the low positivity rate. So anytime we get a new case, it pushes back or invalidates our chance to do a variance. We're still in discussions with Secretary Wiesman, and there's still lots of, as you can imagine, varying opinions on what the county should do or what the county commissioners should ask for, what the Board of Health should ask for. What the health officer is recommending, because a lot of that application stems on the, you know, Board of Health approval, health officer approval, Board of County Commissioners approval, a thorough plan to address all those four items that we are continually working on every day. It is a pretty lengthy application, but that doesn't deter us from pursuing it if that's something we're, you know, asked to do. So I hope that answers your question. I think I rambled there a little bit, but.
No, it does. Thank you. Are there any questions from the council? Ashley.
Thank you. Thank you for all of that information, Dave. I was wondering, so you were saying we don't meet the no new cases within the last 3 weeks. Do you know within the last 3 weeks how many new cases there have been?
Well, we just got two confirmed today. There was one a week prior, and we're working on a third right now where they're trying to determine, or I guess a fourth if you want to include the one the week prior, but we're working on one where they're trying to determine the place of residency. So when these are reported to us, they're either reported by a health provider, a medical lab, or they are reported by a lab into the state Department of Health reporting system, so WDRS. And, you know, we monitor all those, you know, all day long. But those are the three avenues they're reported to the health department. And then the case investigation starts from there. And then the contact tracing starts after you identify a list of close contacts from the interviewee. So right now, you know, it's looking like we had three new cases today. Whether or not they decide to give that case to Yakima or give that case to Klickitat. So
Okay.
That'll be a DOH determination, not a local health determination.
And you said the other requirement is has to be less than 2% of the population is active.
No, so less than a 2% positivity rate on the total number of cases or total number of tests. So I think we're sitting at 4% right now. And it's a little kind of a catch 22. I mean, they expanded the criteria to open up testing, but if people aren't sick, then, you know, they don't go get tested. So it's a little difficult to hit that 2%, which is why Secretary Wiesman has stated that that's a debatable kind of criteria. So we'll have that conversation if we ever pursue the variants, but yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
So,
Jan, you have a question?
So just as a quick comment, the governor has been pretty adamant that without any variances, phase two wouldn't start until 3 weeks after phase one, which basically phase one, I think, started technically on Monday. So, so if, you know, with the two cases, we're already 3 weeks out before we could even apply for a variance to move to phase two. And it's my understanding, and David, correct me if I'm wrong, but that the variance currently is just to move to phase two, not correct. To move to phase three or phase four.
No, there's no criteria right now for moving from phase two to three or from three to four. My guess or my assumption, and I hate to use assumptions because you never know what's going to happen, but I guess the trends suggest that we'll continue to see kind of a sporadic cases. We've never really had a curve or a steady flow of cases that have come to our county. They've always been, you know, one or two here on a few days of no cases and then one or two there. And so on. So you'll see, if you look at our epi curve, you'll just see a bunch of, you know, like ticks, you know, one case here, one case there, and so on. So we've never had a steady curve locally, which suggests, you know, some sense of travel to our county, which through our case investigation, there is a clear link to it coming to Klickitat County and not really a community-wide spread. So right now, phase one, we're still in phase one, and we will probably be in that until we either have 3 weeks of no cases and the state continues on their plateau, or the governor sees a downward trend of a number of different statistics and then just opens the state wide to phase two, is my assumption.
David, I guess I have one question.
Since sure.
Most of the cases are showing travel being the carrier of cases locally, with Yakima right now having the highest per capita case count in the Western U.S., how concerning or how much are you guys monitoring and working with health up in Yakima, especially when it comes to the workers that we do expect seasonally to be coming into Klickitat? How concerning is that for you?
It's a huge concern for public health, to say the least. Yeah. We are certainly worried about that movement of people. We always are during an epidemic or a pandemic. As far as our communication with Yakima, we have a weekly meeting with the regional local emergency response coordinators that I attend. We also get their daily sit reps. So we do get a daily report on kind of what's going on in Yakima. Grant is just a phone call away. So anytime I need to talk to him about what's going on in Yakima, he's kind of on speed dial. So we are certainly worried. I think phase two allows non-essential travel. So that kind of is loosely interpreted to travel within your own county. And I think we'll begin to see a lot more addendums and clarification moving forward in these phases from the governor's office. And I think those are coming out daily about you know, with the frequently asked questions, how does that apply? What does it look like? What if I do this? or am I allowed to do that kind of thing? That is happening daily and often difficult to track, but those addendums are coming out constantly regarding his decisions. And I think phase three, if I remember correctly, allows, or I'm sorry, phase three opens up non-essential travel. Phase two allows essential travel. I have to pull up the table again, but phase three is the one. Go ahead, Jeff.
I've got it here in front of me. Phase two is listed as limited non-essential travel within proximity of your home, which a lot of these orders, the reason they need addendums is because the definitions are lacking.
Yeah.
They have not yet defined what is within proximity of your home.
Yeah. And then phase three is the one that we're really worried about, because that opens up the county for travel and tourism. And, you know, I know you, public health and the economy go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other and so on. But there has to be a logical approach to phase three moving forward, because that's, I believe, when we will see more cases come to Klickitat County. So that's the one that we're really preparing for, that phase.
Yeah, and part of that, like you said, I'm sorry, Marley, if I may.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, part of that discussion with Public Health, EOC, and gorge area landowners for public recreation is, how do we do that, whole, you know, allowing visitors back to the gorge, like was announced, you know, Washington State Parks will open for day use. Well, that actual statement wasn't, you know, all-inclusive. And so none of the state parks in the gorge scenic area proper are opening. Didn't open yesterday, even for day use. The only two in our county actually that did open for day use is the Observatory and Brooks Memorial State Park off of Highway 97. So, because they're not in the gorge scenic area, but, they're trying to manage that so that none of the gorge area counties or cities get overwhelmed with visitors that we can't handle for many different reasons. And that has to do with that, you know, travel restrictions as well. What they are discussing is opening up certain things in the gorge on May 25th. Is the earliest date that I've heard so far in those meetings.
I think Jeff brings up a really good point here about the regional approach. It's really difficult when you have a number of different counties and two in a state line there, with two governors, multiple commissioners, multiple health officers, multiple health departments, multiple EOCs. And when you're trying to, you know, figure out the gorge area and open up the gorge, it really takes that partnership level. And we're really glad that our neighbors across the river have been so open to having those discussions.
Yeah, there were over 100 entities on that gorge area recreation meeting last Friday.
Thank you, guys. Definitely good overview and insight, I think, for everyone that's on the phone. Are there any other questions from counselors? Okay, seeing none, we will let you guys resume your other evening activities if you'd like and move on to our business items. We will be talking more on this front as well, COVID specifically, how the phase reopening impacts some other areas that the city is identifying in that business item 8. But first, business item 3, City of Bingen Wastewater Treatment Plant and Mainline Improvements Project. Jan, do you want to give an overview?
Yeah, so I hope you guys were able to review the memo that was posted on Monday. It gives kind of a background, because a lot of you are probably not familiar with how we jointly fund the treatment plant with the city of Bingen. And so, and then provided some background, and then I focused on the actual project itself. So back in 2016, maybe even 2015, the two cities started working on a joint wastewater system plan. It was jointly funded by both cities. And I think in the memo, I said it was split about 25-75%, which at that time was the ERU rate. As part of the one of the outcomes of that was identifying some improvements to the treatment plant to extend its life for the next 20 years. And then also called out some improvements to what we call the Depot Street line. Depot Street is the line that runs between the buildings on the south side of Highway 14 and the railroad. And there's a main line that carries the majority of White Salmon's waste to the treatment plant. And that line is always at capacity. It was never built correctly. It will have surges in the winter and overflow. And so it needs replaced. And so Gray and Osborne was hired to start designing and engineering those projects in 2017. City of Bingen also applied for state funding for both design, engineering, and construction at that time. At the time, the state said, no, we're not going to fund the construction because we want a shovel-ready project, kind of like what's going on with some of our stuff up here. But they got design funding. And at that time, we were supposed to be working on the interlocal agreement between the two cities that identified how we would fund this project. But due to numerous staffing changes, including myself, that interlocal agreement kind of just got shoved kind of behind in a closet. At the administration level, myself, Pat Munyon, Betty Barnes, and our city's engineers, Anderson Perry, always had kind of this verbal agreement that, yes, the project needs to happen. It needs to be funded how we funded those projects in the past, the source of any matching dollars to whatever state or federal funding was going to be used. Kind of would come from the city's separate capital expansion funds. And so here we are today. The project has already been designed. It's gone out to bid, and they're ready to award the contract. The city of Bingen was awarded a design construction loan for $170,000. 85% of that's a forgivable amount, and then 85% has to be repaid. I mean, $85,000 has to be paid back. They also were awarded construction loans, which includes their funding for engineering, construction, and contingency, though there is a shortfall. And that loan amount is almost $2.9 million. So there is a funding shortage currently. I have a much bigger chart that shows where it all falls into, but it's about $169,575. I've shown kind of how the splits would work. There's a complicated ERU table that I attached. It means a lot to somebody like me and Cheyenne, who's the clerk treasurer down in Bingen. It might not mean a lot to you, but it shows how we determine those splits. To get to the 79-21, I took 4 years worth of the splits. I presented this information last night to the City of Bingen City Council. They voted to tentatively move ahead with this funding scenario and award the contract contingent upon the two cities signing an interlocal agreement. Or approving an interlocal agreement at our next meetings in 2 weeks. We would use the interlocal agreement language that was used for the wastewater system plan, Ken Woodrich was part of approving that language. So with tweaking and making it, you know, putting in the current facts, I think it'll be pretty easy to use that language since it's kind of gone through some attorney review already. And this is pretty straightforward. Two things that we want to put in that interlocal agreement is, one, the city of White Salmon and Benjamin agreed to this, is we want language in there that the overall wastewater interlocal agreement that we've sort of been using, and I talk about it in here, since 1994, 95, and 96, which was a project-based interlocal agreement, but for some reason devolved into governing how we do things related to wastewater in the two cities, needs to be redone, and we need to identify a schedule for that and get it done. Particularly with me retiring in a couple of years, Tom Hans, the operator down in Bingen, is probably looking at a future retirement also. The other thing that Bingen wanted in there is that, you know, the repayment of the loans would be the same split as the funding shortage. And so re-looking at that split every 5 years, and does there need to be any adjustments to that? And so that would mean, like, looking at the ERUs, it's possible Bingen's could tick upward because we have a lot of housing development, or it's possible, I mean, White Salmon's could tick upward, or Bingen's could tick upward because they get a bunch of new development that's industry waste reliant down at the port. So it's possible there could be changes. I've actually been tracking those wastewater ERUs for over 20 years. There's never been a lot of change. It looks like there was some change in from 2017 to 2018 and 2019. But the main reason for that is Underwood Fruit went down. And so, as you know, they had a big fire. They weren't really processing out of Bingen. They were processing out of Dallasport. And then, and so you see in 2020, kind of a change from that 80-20%. It's at like 78-22% right now. And that's because Underwood Fruit came back online at the end of 2019. Bingen Society Hotel came online. But we also expect White Salmon to uptick for a couple of reasons. We've been working with Everybody's Brewing, determining their ERUs, and we have substantial housing development happening, or was happening. I don't know what's going to happen with it in the next couple of years. But we've had some increase in housing, and we'll still see that, I think, continuing on a little bit. So we're recommending tentative approval of the funding scenario based on an interlocal agreement being approved in 2 weeks. And so I don't know if you have any questions related to how we pay for this. And
Ashley?
I'm just curious, could you give a breakdown of better understanding the ERU rate that's being used by Everybody's Brewing? What effect is that?
I really can't at this time. Ashley, we're working with Everybody's Brewing. So right now, this is related to the brewing side of it, not their restaurant side of it. And so typically when an entity is creating industry waste, such as Underwood Fruit or Everybody's, their ERU rate, equivalent residential unit rate, is higher than a normal business for many reasons, which I won't go into. That never happened. A user's agreement was never established with Everybody's. We have been actively working on that. And when we can all come back together, we have as you'll see down below in a consent agenda, we have our wastewater engineer working on developing that ERU rate. And we'll have that information in the future. There'll be a user's agreement that Everybody's will sign with the city of White Salmon, with Bingen sign off because the waste goes into the treatment plant. And so I don't have the specifics yet, but it will increase. They're just basically paying the very base rate that everybody else pays, every other business pays.
All right, thanks, Jan.
Any other questions or comments? So the action required this time is a consensus action. Since we are on the phone, will we still do a roll call, Ken? I think you're muted.
You're muted.
Just unmuting. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's really up to you, Mayor. If you it's not listed as an action item. So, you know, if you wanted just to ask if there's any objections and then move forward pending whether you get a response, then that would be sufficient.
Okay. Then I will ask if there are any objections to move forward with the proposed funding scenario and finalization of a draft interlocal agreement.
I have one more question.
Yes, Ashley.
So Jan, how the different percentages, the, what is it, 80?
We're proposing and using a 79-21% split for the funding.
How often will that split be reevaluated?
Every 5 years. It's a 20-year loan.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, any objections to moving forward with the draft interlocal agreement?
No.
Okay, seeing none, we will consider that by consensus, we are moving forward with the proposed funding scenario and finalization of a draft interlocal agreement. Moving on to business item 4, the task order for Anderson Perry and Associates, update of city's water system plan.
So the reason this is not under the consent agenda, typically task orders that we would Pat would just approve that are under the master program are small amounts. If there are any large amounts or if I think it affects the budget, I will be presenting that as a separate agenda item. So I think we've previously noted, I think when we were talking with that we hired Anderson Perry, that we needed to update the city's water system plan. It expires in 2020, so we're going to be working on it. It will not be done in 2020, but we've already met with the Department of Health. They're aware that we're working on it. We've had our initial planning meeting. And so, like many state agencies, as long as you can document that you are working to comply, they will work with you. And so, Anderson Perry has provided us with a scope of work and a cost. And I think when I mentioned, you know, when we did the budget amendment a few weeks ago, I mentioned that I had budgeted $70,000 for that, but it might need to go up. The initial cost when it was presented to Pat and I was $110,000. So we were able to get them to come down $20,000. And so I know this seems like a lot of money, but water system plans cost a lot of money. There's minutia, as you can see, things that the Department of Health requires you to have in a plan. They recently revised their requirements and have added some new things in, which made this probably more expensive than it would have normally been. And so we're recommending that you approve task order for Anderson Perry to update the city's water system plan in an amount not to exceed $90,000.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
Who seconded?
Amy.
Jason.
Motion, Jason seconded. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor, Jan will take roll call.
Jason Hartman.
Aye.
David Lindley?
Aye.
Amy Martin?
Aye.
Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay. Moving on to item 5, personal services contract, Pioneer Surveying and Engineering, design of roundabout at Jewett and Garfield.
So
Jan, this is a Jan-heavy agenda tonight with Pat's absence. You can give the overview.
These essential tasks that we need to get done. So this is the second personal services contract that we had mentioned we would have with Pioneer Surveying and Engineering. They're doing, you know, the TIB project at Garfield, so they will tie in together. Because this project is, the roundabout would actually not be constructed until 2022 and would likely be bid and constructed through WashDOT. We are only doing a contract with Pioneer Surveying and Engineering for the design of the roundabout. That will get folded into WashDOT documents, and then they will be doing the construction engineering, hopefully in 2022, if the state doesn't rob that money and to pay for other things. So we are recommending authorizing the mayor to sign a contract with Pioneer Surveying and Engineering for the design of a roundabout at Highway 141, Jewett and Garfield in the amount not to exceed $26,158.
I have a motion.
I'll make the motion.
I'll second.
Is there a second?
Amy seconded.
Jason Hartman motion. Amy seconded. Any discussion?
Yeah, I have a question. Is there any likelihood at all that this money or that the design would not get used, or that this would be a waste of money?
We don't think it would be a waste. WashDOT is pretty committed, understands why we want this. The reality is WashDOT has got to redo Highway 141. This project's been pushed out for a long time. They're going to have to repave it no matter what. And whether it's 2021, 2022, 2023, it will happen. I think we can all see, even before Crestline started tearing it up, the road was deteriorating. And so it's going to have to be repaved, and that's why at the time we will do that project.
I see.
I don't think it's a waste of money.
Yeah. Would there be a way to, and it's okay if there's not, but I'm wondering, is there a way to get WashDOT to commit to implementing this roundabout if we have it designed or anything like that, or is that a...
Well, they have, in emails and in our meetings, they've committed to doing the roundabout. We may, as we're designing it, we're working with WashDOT to make sure that the roundabout meets their requirements.
Okay. That's good.
Yes.
Okay, can we have a motion to authorization to sign the contract with Pioneer Surveying Engineering for the design of a roundabout at Jewett and Garfield in amount not to exceed. Oh, we already had the motion, didn't we? Sorry, guys. Any other discussion? Okay, Jim, would you like to do a roll call vote?
Jason Hartman?
Aye.
David Lindley?
Aye.
Amy Martin?
Aye.
Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, moving on to item 6, grant agreement, Washington Department of Ecology, White Salmon, River Source Reliability Study.
So this is a project that Pat has continuously, I think, kept you updated for the last year and a half when all the newer council members came on originally, and he's recently talked about it. We kind of presented this scope of work previously to you when we actually, submitted it to DOE. It was kind of like, yeah, the city wants to do this. So we have a grant coming from the Department of Ecology of $200,000 for a $245,000 project. We'll have a second grant agreement with the Yakima Nation for $20,000 at our next council meeting. And then the city council will provide matching funds of $25,000. So the document, lengthy document that you have in here is the scope of work and the budget for the $20,000. And then it of course includes all of Department of Ecology's lovely legalese that they require in their agreements. We are requesting authorization for the mayor to sign the agreement with the Washington Department of Ecology for a grant in the amount of $200,000 to conduct the White Salmon River Source Reliability Study.
Can we have a motion?
I'll make that motion.
I'll second
it. Ashley, motion, is there a second? David Lindley seconded. Any discussion?
I just say I'm excited to see this project move forward. This is kind of where my two worlds collide as an ecologist and in this volunteer capacity. And I think it's a great opportunity to build in some redundancy to our water supply and benefit fish at the same time.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, Jan, would you like to take a roll call vote?
Jason Hartman?
Aye.
David Lindley?
Aye.
Amy Martin?
Aye.
Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, moving on to item 7, task order with Aspect Consulting, White Salmon River Source Reliability Study.
So this is, we hired Aspect Consulting with a master contract, kind of as our hydrogeologist, water rights, kind of specialist people. And this is the task order in the complete amount of $245,000 to conduct the White Salmon River Source Reliability Study. Aspect Consulting has been our consulting partner on this project for many years. They've been involved with the ASR. Their main employee, Dan Haller, is an ex-employee at Department of Ecology, and he knows our water rights and our situation inside and out. It would be very hard-pressed to find another consulting firm that has the background knowledge that Aspect Consulting has. I participated in a number of these meetings when I worked for the city of Bingen, working up towards this White Salmon River Source Reliability study. And Aspect Consulting, has done a really good job in bringing all of the different parties together to get to this point, including the Yakima Nation. And so we've got, a group of people that are working very diligently to, as David said, help protect fish and people are interested in the watersheds. So I think it's a good project. And so we're recommending that we approve task order with Aspect Consulting for conducting the White Salmon River Source Reliability Study in amount not to exceed $245,000.
Sorry, I was on mute. Can we have a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Okay, Amy made the motion. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing or hearing none, Jan, would you like to take a roll call vote?
Jason Hartman?
Aye.
David Lindley?
Aye.
Amy Martin?
Aye.
Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, moving on to item 8, COVID-19 planning. So this was added to the agenda last week as we sent the shift to a phased approach statewide. And obviously that was confirmed with Governor Inslee's order at the end of the last week, and feeling that this would be an appropriate time to discuss in more detail with the full council some of the financial implications of how we are supporting the ongoing efforts with the EOC, but also in preparation for anything that the city might have to do in addition, as well as discussion and overview from Ken regarding some of the different legal authorities or Washington State specific laws in these types of situations. There's some understanding of what a city may or may not be able to do in addition to what's happening at the state level. Along with that, we thought that this was a good time to bring the council up to speed with our current approach as we are in phase one. The Jewett Water Main project started this week. Bill will speak to a little bit more detail on how we are handling any construction projects that were already permitted prior to the shutdown, meeting the requirements issued by the governor to be approved to now restart. Jan is going to give an overview on some of the financial aspects, not only the funding of the EOC, but some funding that you might have seen in the news last week has been made available through Governor Inslee and the Federal CARES Act. And then I'll also discuss, Jeff mentioned it during his presentation, but a little bit more detail on where we stand regarding outdoor recreation, since that has been a pretty hot topic gorge-wide and certainly hearing from the community. I think when Ken is diving in on the legal side of things, if Chief Hepner wants to speak as well, coming back to the beginning of this meeting, the comments regarding Songer's release yesterday, I feel like that is a bit top of mind and kind of fits in with that planned conversation we were already having. So part of this, there's no action, but the hope is after you hear all of this, if it spurs some conversation among counselors, we're also trying to just gauge some input and feedback so that if we are finding ourselves in a situation we need to make some policy decisions, we have a sense of where the council might have some areas of concern, or just making sure that we are being transparent and getting your input as well. Ken, would you like to start with just some legal overview?
Sure. Thanks, Mayor. I shared with you folks, I believe, some time ago, an opinion I expressed originally for the city of Washougal relating to I-1639 and local enforcement issues in response to sheriffs of various jurisdictions saying they would not enforce I-1639, and then a push by some gun rights organizations to ask local jurisdictions to create an I-1639, basically a decision not to enforce that locally. I concluded that the courts have certainly defer to the legislature as far as how they have designated local enforcement of the laws. There's something called preemption that deals with whether a local jurisdiction has independent authority to exercise enforcement rights or not of a state statute or other law. But in this instance, in the instance of I-1639, and one of your public commenters drew the parallel there, in the instance of I-1639, the state statutes are very clear that the state preempts all other, that, in other words, they've taken full authority to be able to make, to legislate over gun issues. And that's in the statute very clearly. Moving then from I-1639 to Sheriff Songer's statement, public statement, that he would not enforce the governor's emergency orders, there is a parallel, and that is that in the state statutes, they very clearly under 38.52, I think it's .020 or one of the early sections there, they make very clear that the governor has been designated with the authority to make orders relating to emergency situations statewide. The governor in his order pretty clearly, I think, has stated that his order is a statewide order. He has not deferred to local jurisdictions, which would then make change the preemption picture to a shared enforcement authority. But in this case, the order is statewide. So then the next question is, so he's issued an order. The statute also indicates, and I think I sent to Jan, I think she circulated a couple of statutes that were relevant to this. In chapter 38.52, it says that a violation of that section would be a misdemeanor, and then a continued violation would be a gross misdemeanor. So that puts it within our ability to essentially enforce these provisions locally, because if it were a felony, it would be strictly up to the county for prosecution. But we have, our local prosecutor can prosecute up to a gross misdemeanor. So that local enforcement then, since we, our designated law enforcement officer is Chief Heppner, that puts some of the enforcement issues in his camp, not Sheriff Songer's camp, in Chief Heppner's camp, because he's the local law enforcement officer, and how and whether he enforces the governor's order is really up to him, with the caveat that he, like Sheriff Songer, has taken an oath of office saying he will faithfully enforce the laws of the state of Washington, as well as the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state of Washington. Now, that does not mean that, in my view, that a law enforcement officer can make a constitutional decision. That decision lies very strictly in the state courts. And if somebody has an issue with a provision in a state statute and feeling that it may be unconstitutional, there's a vehicle for testing that. It's called a declaratory judgment. It can be filed in the state superior court, and a judge, which the correct branch of office or the correct, you know, branch of government, can then make a decision based upon the law, whether that is or is not constitutional. That decision then can be appealed up through the Court of Appeals and potentially the state Supreme Court, and even potentially the United States Supreme Court, to test the constitutionality. It's not done at the local law enforcement level. That's cheating. That's skipping an entire branch of government. So, I think it's kind of a little bit, I don't know how to put it, but I think it just simply exceeds the authority of the county sheriff to do as he's suggesting. And what's the repercussion of that? I think somebody in one of the public commenters kind of suggested maybe the city could do something. Well, there's not a lot of the city can do, because the mechanism for responding to that, besides the city could send a letter, I suppose, to Sheriff Songer and indicating our displeasure with his response. But the real mechanism, there are two mechanisms. One is the ballot box. Obviously, that's where you really test how you feel about the way somebody performs. Short of that, if there is a real question about whether he has properly fulfilled his duties, then the way that's tested is through recall. Recall has to be done, it has to be initiated by voters. City is not a voter, so the city could not initiate a recall petition. That recall petition has to state at least two instances of a failure of duty on the part of the elected official. You all as elected officials are also subject to recall. Any elected official in the state of Washington is potentially subject to recall. Then that is then taken to the courts. The courts, Superior Court then would make a decision whether that is, they've sustained a case. And then if they sustain a case, it goes back to the voters to test. The voters then could decide whether or not to recall an elected official. So that's kind of, I suppose, a long-winded, I tried to hit all the points, but I'm certainly open to any questions.
Amy?
So the instances would have to be more than just him coming out publicly saying that he's not enforcing it. It would have to be examples of when he has actually refused to enforce it.
I don't want to opine on a particular, on what an elector, a voter could potentially put in a petition for recall. That's something that would be between a voter and their attorney to decide if there are sufficient facts to sustain a recall petition. I'm a city attorney. I wouldn't be involved in a recall process at all.
And is there a number for the petition when, like, say if this were to move on and someone actually went for this, what is the number for the petition that they would need?
Well, the petition can be brought by any registered voter. And then it's brought before the Superior Court. If the Superior Court sustains it, it goes back to the voters. So you don't necessarily need a number of people on a petition. The petition is a legal petition that's filed with the court, not like a petition, you know, to annex into the city, something like that. It's not a question of numbers. It's a question of whether the facts are sufficient to convince a judge that a recall is appropriate.
That's all I had, sorry.
David?
Ken, I'm curious if you're aware this order has been in place for a while. I'm wondering if there are court challenges making their way via the declaratory judgment route.
I have seen no such challenges in the sense of you know, a recall petition against a law enforcement officer. I know that Franklin County did vote not to enforce the law. They claimed it was unconstitutional. Again, that's the legislative branch of a local jurisdiction taking a position about the legality of the governor's actions. And I think Attorney General Ferguson basically said, nah, that's not right. You can't do it that way. And so, but I'm not sure where that's gone. I don't think anything, to my knowledge, has been filed.
So Franklin County rescinded their policy decision after I believe it was a verbal conversation with the state attorney general and the governor's office. So they are still following, you know, I don't know how far they're enforcing, but they are following the governor's orders. I have read that there's possibly some challenges going to be filed, but that was prior to the governor's four-phase plan, and so that may have settled some people down. It was coming out of the kind of the I-5 corridor area, some of the Seattle, that more populous area.
Well, it's all, as you well know, it's a moving target. The governor is responding to the public health conditions as they're evolving, but you know, who knows what will happen from day to day.
Amy? Ken, one question or maybe a hypothetical, and it seems pretty clear from what you've outlined that within White Salmon city limits, we are still operating with the authority under our police chief and enforcing or following the guidelines that are coming down from the governor. In a scenario where the sheriff may or could intervene or try to insert himself into a decision that perhaps is made by our police chief, is it just null and void? It's only words? Or is there a mechanism in place, or what concerns should we have if we find ourselves in that type of situation? An example being a non-essential business opening ahead of the phase period that they're currently allowed to operate. We shut them back down and the sheriff potentially comes in and gives them his opinion, or that person is then feeling more empowered to challenge what the city's directive is because of an express support from someone like the sheriff.
Well, that's a challenging hypothetical, Mayor. I wouldn't like to see something like that happen. And I would think, I know Mike well enough to know that I think he would be very discreet about how he handles the interagency dispute there. It might be something ultimately that the city and the county would have to adjudicate potentially. But, you know, the city has our own enforcement authority through our chief of police. So I think they'd be in a struggle to suggest that Sheriff Songer has higher enforcement authority over a misdemeanor offense than our own designated chief of police.
Jason?
Has Klickitat County spoken out, taken a position one way or the other?
I don't think anything has come from the commissioners. I believe that Sheriff Songer read or made the commissioners aware of his statement on Tuesday in person at the commissioner meeting. But there has not, as far as I know, any published statement from the commissioners. I anticipate that this will be something that is discussed among the commissioners and mayors, especially in line with what's been talked about tonight regarding outdoor recreation and the public health component to that, but also this attempt to manage at a bi-state level, what opening could look like and additional guidelines and restrictions and the assistance that we may be looking to have from law enforcement. And if there is a sense that that is not occurring or could be absent in our county. Amy?
So Ken mentioned an option being writing a letter to Songer, just voicing how we feel about it. Is that something that we want to entertain, or is that kind of a...
Do any counselors want to weigh in on that question? I believe is being posed to counselors.
I've wondered about if there's anything we should do to reassure residents of White Salmon. But I also feel like hesitant to engage in some sort of dispute with Sheriff Songer, where, if this is making this political on his part, I don't necessarily want to respond in turn and continue to make it political. But I wonder if it would be helpful to have a statement from Chief Heppner. I don't know if that's something you would be comfortable with. On what your response is.
Maybe when you guys are.
Okay.
So, obviously I took the same oath. And from the beginning,
I knew when I took this job, in law enforcement generally, the oath says I will uphold all laws of the state of Washington, along with the Constitution and the state constitution. And I'm obviously going to follow that, even the governor's proclamation, I will follow that, and that's how it will go. The governor, along with the Washington sheriffs and chiefs of police, have suggested warning, 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 warning to people, which we have been doing, and everything's been fine. And so far, we've had no issues. Just so you are aware, I have reached out to both city prosecutors, Bingen and White Salmon. White Salmon's prosecutor, Ron Rainier, is listening in right now. And if it comes to a time that I need to take the next step, he backs it. If I find that I need to go from warning, warning, warning to criminal citation, they will prosecute it. So that's where I stand, is the state law. When I chose this, that's the job I chose. I will uphold the state laws, including proclamations by the governor.
Jason?
So to answer Amy's question, I think I like what Ashley was saying. I'd rather not jump into a political firefight, because it seems like it might just fizzle out. If anything, it wouldn't be a bad idea, maybe in the paper or something, to just kind of reiterate what we're doing, or somehow make the city of White Salmon residents aware that we do take it seriously. I don't know if that's something that, you know, if that would be difficult, or if that's something that needs an authorization of the council or something like that. I think you know, just something that explains that, you know, the steps that the city is taking to uphold the governor's order.
Yeah, Ken, correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense is along the lines of what Jason's saying. The city could issue a statement, a news release of sorts, just reiterating our position and how we, as we move into these phases, how we will be enforcing or providing guidance to city residents. And in that, we could be also affirming what that structure of enforcement is and the authority of our local police department. I do agree with some of the comments regarding a hesitancy to engage in something that I think at this point, based on Ken's analysis, is pretty thin in terms of how much backing Sheriff Songer really would have legally with this position that he's taking. And so I think to engage in the back and forth potentially is a distraction from what our real focus is, which is trying to reinforce to not only the city but the larger county the importance of taking the guidance from our public health officials and the state, and moving forward with a focus on a responsible reopening when it's permissible, and in the meantime, continuing to ensure public safety. So I do think there is that risk right now of engaging in a back and forth directly with him that we're almost stooping to his level, because I don't think that he's backed by any legal strength. And in a lot of ways, he doesn't have power in terms of enforcement within the city. Jan, I think you wanted to say something.
Well, and I think, you know, I think our COVID-19 webpage and the city's webpage in general is consistently, you know, supporting that message already. I do think, you know, a news release just kind of reiterating that is probably a good thing, just to remind our citizens that there is a plan, and that we're following that plan, and that, you know, just reminding them of all the information that's available on the city's webpage. I imagine that over the next few weeks, or probably the next 2 months, I'm going to be pretty busy keeping that webpage updated. As Jeff and David noted, there's lots of new information. We're kind of back into that, tons of new information coming out every day. I mean, the governor just issued a couple of new guidance documents on some phase one activities. And I've already shared those with a couple of churches locally. So, you know, keeping that information up front on our webpage is critical. I've had a couple businesses call. One of them she just was honest, she just doesn't do the internet. And so she has a phase two business. And she wasn't real thrilled when I told her that it was probably at the minimum of 3 weeks before she could even consider opening. But she's going to give me a call back in a couple weeks, because who knows where the governor will move one direction or the other. We just have to keep watching that.
Jeff.
I just want to let you know that the EOC could provide support with our PIO to help you with any of that messaging, Jan. We do work for the city as well, and so anything you need from the EOC, just need to ask.
Right, yeah, no, I think most of the stuff I'm posting comes from the EOC, and I think, you know, we've been keeping our website updated. So, I mean, if we get into a point where we need actual some writing, we would certainly contact you, but most of the stuff I post comes right from EOC anyways.
Just an offer.
Yep. I think we got it.
Yes, Jason.
Yeah, I think, like Jan said, just something that points people back to the website. There's so much information there. I think you guys have been doing an awesome job of keeping the public informed, but maybe not everybody in the city knows that all that stuff is there if they're not looking, but it seems like that would be easy.
Yeah. David.
Yeah, I would just say I agree with what's been said and kind of lean on the side of not engaging on the subject. I mean, I feel it's sort of hyperbole. I mean, some people might take it literally, but I think it's a form of grandstanding, and it's a case of where you kind of ignore and not engage. If there's minimal effort to sort of reaffirm our commitment, that's great, but I think our staff has probably more pressing work to do. So, yeah, I'm fine with just sort of ignoring this.
Yeah, to me, I think until we reach a point where his words are becoming an action that's detrimental to the health and safety of our community because of county actions. And by that, I mean a situation where we have the gorge reopening in a certain time frame, and there are measures in place to mitigate crowds or make sure guidelines are being followed. And if we are needing the support of law enforcement and that's not being provided, then I think we're at a different place in a different conversation. I think at this point, we need to keep focused and staying with the same approach that we've had, which is taking this seriously and putting the public health and safety first. And knowing that the enforcement that we have within the city is in lockstep with how we are moving forward, and to engage in the back and forth, I think is a bit of a distraction when there isn't a test moment in essence that's really come to the forefront. And hopefully we don't get there. I will say right now that, you know, the conversations with the EOC and with all of the elected officials countywide has been unified, and we have all been in agreement, especially as we go into these phases, about shared concerns regarding an influx of people coming into the county, especially for some of the popular activities that bring tourists in the summer and spring. So despite the sheriff's statements, I don't think those are indicative of any other change in approach that's happening where the real authority lies on overseeing this emergency at the county or city levels. Are there any other comments or questions specific to that dynamic of law enforcement? So Ken, one other area I was hoping you could speak to is just the dynamic of city authority with state authority. So in this dynamic, it would be a discussion about should the state level be moving forward in phases, and we do see community spread or cluster outbreaks unique to the western side of the county and white salmon specifically. What can the city do in terms of implementing stricter controls if needed?
Well, I think we're in the world of preemption. The governor has basically assumed authority over the phasing of reopening the state. As far as additional controls, we can enact, you can adopt your own emergency orders that arguably could be stricter than the governor's, but you have to have a basis for that. There has to be, you have to have a tangible reason why your order is more strict than the governor's. And if you don't have that, then I think the safe harbor is to fall back on the governor's orders and stick with those, as opposed to kind of going out on your own.
And just to clarify, in the opposite direction, similar to what happened in Franklin, a county or city doesn't have the authority to go looser on these current orders unless there was an avenue like these variances that have been allowed by the governor. But you couldn't go the other direction and try to, on your own, just outright ignore or override what has been outlined at the state level for the approach that we're taking. Is that right?
That was my prior discussion, and I am sticking with it.
Any other questions for Ken or comments on anything related to legal aspects of this current emergency situation? Okay. Jan is moving on, I guess, into finances. She has a few updates just on the front of some funding that's been made available, and just to bring you guys into better awareness on how we are supporting the EOC, since it is an operation funded by the three cities and the county.
So funding from the federal government came to the state. Some funding came from the federal government directly to some certain larger cities. And so the state governor's office has made some decisions to distribute that CARES Act funding to counties and to cities. And there were some documents posted on the webpage for the meeting. There's kind of a guidance document from the treasurer's office. There was a one-page, very short, frequently asked questions, which today expanded to 7 pages. And I will forward that document on to you. At this point in time, and this is certainly subject to change because the funding has not been distributed, but the city of White Salmon is identified to potentially be receiving $78,300. There are restrictions on how this funding can be used. I think everyone's being a little cautious on it because there hasn't been, up until today, a whole lot of guidance. And so there's certainly more guidance now with 7 pages of frequently asked questions. But it's very clear that these funds, the city has to make findings about the necessity of using this money. It has to be used directly related to COVID-19. It cannot supplant funding if we're already, it's possible that if I had been diverted and was working up at the EOC full time or even half time, it is possible that that money could be used to pay for that portion of my salary that was being used for that. We don't have any employees like that. If we had a jail and we were taking, you know, some employees from the jail and having them do something different related to COVID-19. But for the most part, it can't be used for salaries or benefits. There's some new guidance. It could be used for some grants for businesses. It could certainly be used related to public health expenses, medical health expenses. So, you know, larger cities and much larger counties are going to quickly find means to use this funding. I do believe we could use this funding to pay for our share of the EOC costs. But Marla and I have talked. Part of us want to kind of wait and see what other similar sized cities are going to do and kind of get some cues from them, because we certainly don't want to spend this money on something and then have to repay it. That would not be a fun scenario. And so we're proceeding cautiously. And like I said, I'll send you the new 7 pages of frequently asked questions. We don't need to, spend this money now. It will come into our coffers eventually. We just, need to know that it's there and that we're not spending it. There was a cost analysis that's been provided by the EOC that we've shared with you. It kind of identifies some current costs and the kind of the splits about how that funding would be split between the county and the 3 cities. Currently, it's identifying that Benjamin White Salmon as a whole would pay for 15% of those costs, with it split between Benjamin and White Salmon. I think the mayor of Benjamin is comfortable with that 50-50 split of that 15%. I'm a little uncomfortable with it. I really think it should be split based on our population. I actually think we should offer that to Benjamin. If they want to continue, on the 50-50 split, then, I guess that's their decision. But I think the city of White Salmon should consider offering to pay for that 15% based on our population. And that population's about 72-28% split. Almost pretty close to what our ERUs are. And so I think Jeff is still on. He can probably speak a little bit more to all the minutia details of this. But as this goes on into the rest of the year, they currently have, $50,000 kind of out there. We haven't spent that amount of money, correct, Jeff? But we likely will spend it.
We have not spent that. Let's see, the cost analysis dated May 4th shows that currently under the split between Benjamin and White Salmon, White Salmon's portion of the actual expenses is $719.32. We are purchasing, now that PPE is becoming commercially available, we're trying to purchase a quantity of that is reasonable to have in our inventory in case we have a case outbreak and a spike or a hot spot, that we need to provide that PPE to our emergency responders or hospitals. We're going to spend more of that money in the just near future, but whether we spend all of it, remains to be seen.
Right. And that is something the city is going to have expenses related to PPE also. We're already incurring some of those costs at public works level. you know, we'll probably have some related to the police department, fire department, and we definitely will have some at City Hall when we get to phase three and we reopen our offices here. And so I don't know what those costs are yet. We're starting to do that planning and looking at like how much we're gonna need and what those costs will be.
And if I might also to point out that it was authorized, can't remember when that was, back on the middle of last month, those volunteers, the people that have been volunteering to work in the EOC for over a month at that point, some of them, the policy group, including the mayors and the county commissioners, authorized to hire those folks as emergency hires and pay them minimum wage if they wanted to do so. And out of the, I think at the time there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 or 15 volunteers, staff in the EOC, only six of them wanted to take advantage of that. That amount was also agreed to be split by all three entities, that same calculation. So that's in the process of being done. And that's a cost that's not yet shown on the cost analysis.
Any questions or comments regarding any of the financial overview? Okay, David? No.
I guess just a question. It sounded like the way you described it, Jan, that this isn't like you incur a cost and then you submit for reimbursement, that eventually when the money flows, we'll receive something like $78K and then throughout the rest of the year, we submit documentation for how that was spent.
And then, or we return it.
Gotcha. Okay. Thanks.
Right. And so it has to be coded very specifically and tracked very carefully on how we spend it, all the documentation, findings by the city council on how we spend it.
Okay. Thanks.
And I am not putting it in an interest-bearing account. I'm not tracking that. I don't even want to deal with that headache.
Okay, moving on to a discussion regarding our current phase one. Bill, do you want to give everyone just an overview of how we are handling those construction projects that are coming back online? I think you're on mute.
You're muted.
Thank you for waking me up. I've been contacted by some contractors that do fall into the phase one to get started on. There are some paperwork things that contractors have to do for the COVID. They have to post warnings. They have to, you know, we've put it out to the contractors so that they know what it is. If they haven't, we'll get it out to them some more. Right now, we have one that is qualified that I have started up with today. He's going to pour concrete tomorrow, and I'm working with several others. I have been contacted for like three, four other contractors just waiting for new construction to get started too. So they're hoping to get going as soon as they can. Any questions on my ramblings?
And just for if any council members get questions, all of that information is on our webpage. And as that, if we get any updates, all that information will be posted to our webpage. And so typically under news, there'll be news blurbs that come out with files attached to that, but also under COVID-19, the banner across the top of the page, you just click on that and all that information is on there. And so they can check it out and download the governor's requirements.
Okay, we've already touched a little bit on outdoor recreation, so This probably won't be too much longer in terms of additional details, but just to reiterate what Jeff King said, there was a comprehensive bi-state meeting last Friday. It is anticipated that there will be another one on May 15th. Right now, the focus is to get input from all counties on both sides of the state that are in the gorge area. Their concerns, feedback, mindset regarding the opening of trails and activities in these areas. I think it was mentioned earlier, but obviously May 5th has come and passed, and a lot of the recreation that opened in other parts of the state is still not open here. And that is intentional. The effort is with U.S. Forest Service, state parks for both Washington and Oregon, DNR, any other county or port-held lands. And the input that's been received so far collectively is the sense that there is a need for some unified messaging in terms of once a plan to reopen is identified. Some of the things that were expressed in terms of concerns were just the strain on the rural towns that are near some of these facilities, which is certainly something that here in White Salmon we have as well. Knowing that a lot of these trails, when they do reopen or visitor sites, are going to continue to keep their restrooms closed, which is currently our plan as well, to out of a sense that we don't have enough manpower to keep up with the constant cleaning that would be required to keep them hygienic during this period. What that influx could mean to some of the businesses that are remaining open. There's also concerns about an uptick then in short-term rentals or overnight tourism and travel. And then the strain, if certain activities are opened in one county versus others, how that county could be overwhelmed. And so it was certainly mentioned across the board, a sense that there needs to be some coordination among all these entities. That next meeting on May 15th was done to give some time to evaluate the few things that are open, what the traffic is looking like, and how those areas are being used, and if some of the still recommended guidelines are indeed being followed. So I will keep you guys aware. I think that the sentiment certainly is that at some point, you know, a lot of our businesses depend on this type of travel and frequenting of these facilities as well, not to mention locals that are just anxious to get out, but also currently have been very much in support of seeing the need to not encourage a lot of incoming travel. So I think all of those things are being weighed collectively, but it's all being done with the intent of figuring out a plan on how to move this forward, not with an intent of keeping everything closed indefinitely. So I do think there will be updates as the month goes on. I think that's kind of everything that's was outstanding on the outdoor recreation side. I think just to reiterate a lot of this discussion, what's been mentioned, obviously, as we move into these phases, you know, the phases aren't an acknowledgement that the risk is going away. It's just an acknowledgement that we perhaps are better prepared with the right supplies and a sense that our medical facilities and resources could handle the cases that could arise. If we were to see an influx of cases or community spread and or cluster locally, that's where I think some of the funding that Jan outlined would be that safety net that we do have to be able to support in other ways what might already be accounted for through the EOC. But we are looking at this right now that it is going to be a long-term or at least continually extended period that we find ourselves in. So we're trying to get out in front of some of the planning that we can do, not only for how to help support the things that open during these phases. That includes efforts the city could do to make sure that our businesses, when they come back online, do feel like there is some support there to help them, because obviously being closed this long has been a big burden. As Bill mentioned, we've been working with the contractors and projects that are coming back already, making sure that they are still adhering to all those guidelines and requirements from the governor. So anything that is coming down, we are very mindful of making sure we're following any of those guidelines or restrictions. Are there any questions? Ashley.
Just to clarify, were you part of that bi-state meeting, or will you be part of the next?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this first meeting, they really wanted input from elected officials. So there was an opportunity for every county sheriff, a commissioner chair, all the land managers and mayors to add additional comments. Obviously, at the end of the call, since there were so many on, most of the comments had already been expressed, but I certainly expressed some of the concerns that I outlined to you guys. Any other questions or just general thoughts? If you guys have feedback generally about anything related to COVID-19 or things that you are hearing from the community that you want to relay to your other counselors or to staff or myself.
I've just been hearing, sorry, not just been hearing, but I've heard some frustration that locals aren't able to use any of the trails, that they're being closed down, or in the state parks that they're being closed down just because of that would encourage tourism. And one person mentioned to me that I think in the Denver area, I don't know if they've required permits or how they've done it, but they've made it so that only locals can use recreational areas. And I don't know if that was part of your guys' discussion at all.
It's definitely on the table of things that are being considered. Hood River County, they just moved last week to open up some of their facilities, and they're taking that local approach. Some of their way that they're enforcing that is not allowing parking or driving. And so the thinking being, if you can walk or bike to access those facilities. I think some of the difficulties at this point when that conversation is being explored is, especially here, I think a lot of our locals consider, you know, Coyote Wall or Catherine Creek are local trails. But if we had to bike or walk there, then that becomes your activity just to get there. So that distance is kind of a factor if you were to try to mitigate local access in that way. Obviously, there's been a permitting system for a few years at Dog Mountain. I think that's something that's been addressed, is could you do a certain, you know, required permit that's necessary, and then you're monitoring that at the parking lots, and the permit's either indicating your locale, if you stay local, or if it is a broader opening up gorge-wide, are you getting a period of time that you can partake in that, you know, do you have two shifts, in essence, at a space? So it is being discussed, and I think that is acknowledged and realized among all of us, and including many of us. We all want to, I think, be able to move around a bit more and access some of these areas that feel very local. So trying to balance that need of bringing those things back to our residents, but also realizing that the nature of it, if there aren't clear guidelines or a system in place, is that it's going to bring in other people, which is what we saw at the beginning of this. And that wasn't a bi-state effort. And so I think that's why there's a lot of motivation now to have better coordination across both sides of the river to not overwhelm certain sites, which is what happened at some of our Klickitat trails before they were closed.
Thanks, Marla.
Any other thoughts or comments? Okay. I think I have to flip back in my packet to get to the consent agenda. And I guess just to follow up, so we will move forward from the city issuing a statement that we'll post to our website, at least reiterating our approach to the handling of the current phases and also guidelines that are coming from the state. That will address in a veiled way some of the concern that residents are having about Sheriff Songer's statement, but we're not going to actively engage and call it out in that detail because I think based on the discussion tonight, there is a consensus that there's not a lot of meat to what he's putting out there. It's more just an attempt to, I think, fuel some fires. Mm-hmm. I'll look for counselors if anyone's in disagreement with that summary, but okay. Okay, the consent agenda. Is there anything on the consent agenda, either the Anderson Perry and Associates task order for ERU calculation for everybody's the Crestline Jewett Water Main Line Replacement Project Change Order, the task order for Bell Design, mobile home setback requirement drawing, or approval of minutes for our April 15th meeting, and the approval of vouchers in the amount of $338,586.72. Any of those items that a counselor would like to remove from the consent agenda? Okay. Jan, would you like to take roll call for consensus?
We need a motion first and a second.
Oh.
Second.
2 hours in Zoom, getting fatigued. Okay, Jason made the motion. Joe seconded.
Jason, you're muted.
Thanks. I'll make the motion.
Okay. And then who seconded? Joe?
Second, yep.
Okay. So Jason Hartman?
Aye.
David Lindley?
Aye.
Amy Martin?
Aye.
Ashley Post?
Aye.
Joe Turkowitz?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay, department head reports. Chief Heppner, anything else you would like to touch on?
No, unless any of the council members would like to ask me a question.
I have a question, actually. I was listening into the recording from the Bingen City Council meeting from yesterday evening, and you were commenting on the fact that Bingen's had a significantly low number of calls, and that White Salmon's has been particularly high. I was wondering if you had any additional comment on that.
And that's been from the last couple of weeks. At the beginning of the month, we were fairly quiet. And then it's picked up in the last couple of weeks. And I think a lot of that has to do with people not being able to get out and get around. Our domestics went up in town the last couple of weeks, which is, I don't want to say normal because it's not normal, but it's going up everywhere. Then we had quite a few criminal mischiefs. The biggest one was when the guy tagged the city. But in Bingen, their call volume has been very low. So I don't have an answer other than people were more populated up here.
Chief Hunsacker, anything you'd like to add?
No, like I said, I'm here for questions for any of you guys. I kind of talked a little bit about the building department. I'm working on some other letters on code enforcement while I'm just trying to stay on top of emails and people and questions and trying to figure out what they can and can't do. That's the hardest part. So,
Russ, any updates?
We're still working on a split crews with Crestline starting up. They are going to be working the full 8-hour days, which gives us a chance to catch up on some other stuff too. So also making sure that our crews are wearing their proper PPEs during all this. So.
Ken, any other legal updates?
Well, you may or may not have heard that the governor extended the prohibition on live meetings through May 31st, sad to report. The prohibition, the allowing us to not necessarily respond to the 5-day period for public records requests is only extended to May 11th. So we'll see what happens after that date for public records requests. But anyway, it's going on.
good to know about public records. Jan, any updates?
Yeah, so our next meeting will be by teleconference. At that meeting, I think there will be a discussion after we have some discussion with Ken about what we're going to do with the housing moratorium and the Conference of Plan update. We've tentatively left the Planning Commission meeting for the 27th on the books. As it looks right now, that would also be a teleconference meeting. And we'll, you know, probably have more discussion about that at the May 20th City Council meeting. Everyone else is still working from home. That seems to be working pretty well. I am getting a lot more knocks on the door because people are getting antsy out there and they, for some reason, don't read signs. clearly says we're closed and why. But I've listened to them baying for a good 5 minutes out there because I think they know I'm in here. I tend to ignore them, and then occasionally I'll get an email from somebody and respond to why we're closed and how they can move ahead with whatever it is they need to move ahead with. We are getting more questions, I think, is like Bill, from business owners about when they might be able to reopen up.
Updates from my end, I guess, on the bridge side of things. Obviously, we've heard from a lot of people, and May 1st, that toll charging returned. It's posted at the bridge, and it's been reiterated by the port, but if you are without a Easy Pass transponder and you are a cash paying customer, if you go to the port, their website, there's instructions for how to pay the toll within 7 days. You avoid that $3 surcharge. The port is confirming that once restrictions are lifted, they would return toll takers. And so this is not a permanent change from cash over to this automated system, but they are planning to keep that automated system for anyone that is dodging the toll in the future and just driving through and not paying a toll taker. You might have seen it in the paper that came out today, but there was a release just detailing the bi-state committee that has been formed, and we have been meeting now for a few months. The focus right now with that committee is really figuring out a way forward in terms of what authority for the new bridge would look like, taking into account the needs on both sides. So considerations of a bi-state authority or what oversight of the bridge could look like that wouldn't be the port of Hood River, what has currently been the structure. And a lot of that conversation is also focused on best paths forward for funding. So it did detail some of the grants that I've mentioned in the past that we have applied for. There's no updates yet on those statuses, but those efforts are still moving forward. Another note to throw out to all of the counselors, Representative Mossbrooker has started community calls for all of her constituents related to COVID-19. She's splitting it up by region. This started last week for our portion of Clickitat County. The calls tend to be a mixture of representation of different governing bodies and elected officials. Of course, for White Salmon, that needs to be two counselors or less, so we don't have a quorum, but the calls also include local business owners and different community organizations. So if there are two counselors that would like to join the call, the next one is scheduled for tomorrow, I believe at 2 or 2:30, I'll confirm, but let me know and then I can send you the information. We just wanna make sure there are only two counselors that would call in. On the moratorium front is 2 o'clock?
Yeah.
Perfect. Great. On the moratorium front, as Jan mentioned, we are still keeping the May 27th commission meeting on the calendar. In the past, I talked about how we had reworked the calendar, which we had done, and now that the extension is continuing on live meetings, we're shifting focus to do more of a priority list of the things that really need to get addressed while we're in the moratorium, which most critically are the zone changes that would be considered. some of the other items that were initially slated for movement during the moratorium, we are evaluating those moving appropriately lower on the list because they could, in theory, be conversations ongoing while some of the moratorium is lifted or when the moratorium term is up. On the administrative side of things, we are starting to work towards what a joint management plan could look like with the county in terms of the management of the urban exempt area. That was something that was identified, and we're looking to move that forward. If you guys have any questions on that front, reach out to me. I will also try to update each of you on where things stand now that we're kind of getting a more clear picture of what May is going to look like. I think those are the main updates on my end. Yes, to go to counselors, I'll go to my direct right, which is Joe. Any updates or comments?
Nothing personally. I just weathering the storm, trying to stay home as much as possible or around my house, and looking forward to getting out a little bit. Fishing season's opening up a little bit, so I'm going to try to take advantage of that. Hope everybody else will do the same and enjoy themselves, and hopefully I'll get through it.
Ashley?
No updates.
David?
No updates. I just say, you know, continue appreciation and support for the extra efforts of us staff and the mayor, and particularly appreciate, you know, the efforts made to restart the waterline project. I think that's I heard the most from constituents about why can't that be knocked out, why we're shut down sort of thing. So glad every effort was made to safely restart that as soon as possible under the governor proclamation.
Jason?
No updates from me. Thanks.
Amy?
No updates.
All right. I believe we have no executive session needs. Okay. I see Ken shaking his head. Any other items or issues to address? Okay, seeing none, we will adjourn. Thank you all.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you.